Chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis are on the rise in our country. That's from a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's called the Annual Sexually Transmitted Disease Surveillance Report. One takeaway, it documented that chlamydia makes up more than 1.6 million of the new cases. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Two guests to get us up to speed this morning. David Harvey is the executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. That's a national public health organization. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Dr. Peter Leone is a professor of medicine and an adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. He's an expert on sexually transmitted diseases. Dr. Leone, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to start with you, Dr. Leone. This report revealed that Americans were infected with more than 2 million cases of sexually transmitted diseases. What's your reaction to this report?
Dismay. This is the second year where we've had an increase in all three reported STDs. It's the highest level ever, with over 2 million cases combined. And a particular concern is that unless we put more resources and begin to change, I think, our approach to sexually transmitted infections and sexual health, I think these numbers are going to continue to go up.
David, you said this is a failure of our public health care system. How is our health care system responsible for this?
Well, in several ways. State STD prevention and control programs, in addition to cities and the U.S. territories, all have programs that are funded by the federal government, as well as some state dollars. But unfortunately, over the last 20 years, we've seen a huge erosion in public financing for these programs. And I argue there's a direct correlation between reduced resources and the fact that we now have an out-of-control STD epidemic, an epidemic of infectious diseases in this country. So we are calling upon Congress and the Trump administration to increase resources to the tune of at least $40 million in this next fiscal year. That's the beginning of a down payment, which we think would make a huge difference in educating people, providing services, and helping people understand the implications of STDs for their lives.
David, when you looked at this report, what jumped out at you?
Oh, it's an unacceptable situation in the United States. We have the highest STD rates of any Western industrialized nation. So this speaks to a lot of issues and problems that we have, you know, access to health care, talking openly, normalizing issues around sexual health, working with our health care providers, including the wonderful Dr. Peter Leone, to help other clinicians ensure that they are screening, asking patients their sexual histories so that we can better determine risks and increase screening, testing, and treatment. These are all part of the larger problem of how to prevent STDs.
Dr. Leone, the report noted that 2016 was the year of the highest number of STDs that's ever been reported. Can you compare these numbers to recent years, what you've seen in the past through these annual reports?
Well, I think with syphilis, it's a great example. We hit historic lows for syphilis right around the turn of the century. There had been a concerted effort by CDC in the late 1990s to try to eliminate syphilis from the United States. It was successful around heterosexually transmitted infections. However, as what typically happens when we have success, program funding gets cut. So funding was actually reduced around syphilis elimination. And at that time, we began to see the emergence of syphilis among men who have sex with men in particular. But like most STDs, they don't remain confined to one particular group. And so we've seen this broad increase in syphilis, both in men and women, and more recently in congenital syphilis. What is concerning is that the numbers are up somewhere around 15 to almost 20% for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis in 2016 from numbers compared in 2015. So these numbers have gone up. In the case of syphilis, they pretty much steadily have increased since about 2001, 2002. So we've seen this, but we've continued to see an erosion in funding, a reduction in clinic hours, and an increase in copay in many cases for STD screening, all of which I think have contributed to the rising numbers.
So you see those as barriers to getting access to either treatment or discerning if the STD is there.
Exactly. I mean, all three of these sexually transmitted infections are treatable with current antibiotics. In many cases, in most cases, a single dose of treatment will work. And although we're concerned about resistance, and that's something we may can talk about later in terms of antimicrobial resistance around gonorrhea, we have effective therapy. So we have treatment. The issue with many of these STDs are that unless you're screened, you may be missed. So the majority of sexually transmitted infections actually are asymptomatic, meaning people don't have symptoms. That requires that they have to have a test that's routinely done in order to pick up infection and treat that person before they can either develop a disease themselves or transmit it to somebody else. So if you begin to cut funding and put up barriers for people to get the test, as a result, the numbers continue. People remain infected for a longer period of time and can transmit that to other individuals.
Talking right now with Dr. Peter Leone. He's a professor of medicine and an adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina, an expert on STDs. David Harvey, also with us, executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. That's a national public health organization. We're talking about a new report from the CDC. It's called its annual Sexually Transmitted Disease Surveillance Report. Numbers on that report at an all-time high. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you think America should address the rising STD epidemic? How do you think we need to change the way America teaches about sexual health? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. David, looking at these numbers from a demographic standpoint, where are we seeing the highest rates?
Well, Dr. Leone is an epidemiologist, so he's going to be able to comment on this as well. But what I would point out is a few things. One is we've seen increases across all population groups, but there are disproportionate burdens of STDs within communities of color, the southern states, and disproportionately impacting gay and black men who have sex with men, gay men. And so these are a set of issues that overlay on other social disparities that we have in this country. So it's one more issue to try to confront.
Dr. Leone, how about social disparities and the link to STDs?
Well, I think another way to think about this is if you have resources and access to care, you can avail yourself of screening and treatment. Those populations that are more marginalized are frequently the ones that are hit disproportionately with all sorts of diseases, disease outcomes. That's true for sexually transmitted infections as well. So we are seeing our highest rates among minorities and people of color, in particular African Americans, young adults. Native Americans are frequently not part of the discussion, and yet they have some of the highest rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia in the U.S. The issue for MSM is one that is of vital importance because of the association of HIV acquisition and transmission. And so we want to make sure that individuals know that one way of preventing acquisition of HIV or transmission of HIV is to make sure that you don't have another STI or sexually transmitted infection. So screening is important, and yet there's still social stigma around talking about sex and sexuality, which is why I think you had mentioned earlier about changing how we have discussions around sex. Rather than focusing on disease, we want to try to frame all of this in terms of sexual health. So a person goes in and has screening for blood pressure or for their blood sugar to make sure that they don't develop hypertension or have consequences of high blood pressure like cardiovascular disease or strokes. In this case, we think that we should be talking about good health behavior. Because the numbers are so high, getting screened is really important to protect you and to protect your partner, and yet that should be just something that you do when you go in for care. But if you don't have a primary care provider, if you don't have access in your community because the clinics are not open or closed, or if there's stigma around talking about your sexually transmitted infection, all of those are barriers that lead to these numbers that we're talking about.
We're taking a closer look at data right now from the CDC's new report on STDs. We're joined with David Harvey by Skype. He's the executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. And Dr. Peter Leone, he's an adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. How do you think America should address STDs? Do you have a personal story about STDs you wish to share? Let's discuss 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after this news. The CDC is urging better screening and prevention of STDs that have hit an all-time high, according to its most recent annual report that tracks sexually transmitted diseases. Why are the infection numbers growing, especially in light of teen pregnancies having plummeted to a historic low over the past 30 years? We're digging into the new CDC report with David Harvey, who is the executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. And Dr. Peter Leone stays with us. He's a professor of medicine and an adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. He's also an expert on STDs. You can join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Do you have a loved one in your life who has an STD? What's that been like? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Paul from Eau Claire emailed. He says, men's sexual behavior hasn't changed in the past 100 years, but women's sexual behavior has. His question, what social factors do you believe have led to this STD surge? David, do you want to start?
Oh, I think I might punt to Dr. Leone.
Dr. Leone, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that obviously sexual behavior has changed since the 60s, and yet we're seeing higher STD rates now than we've seen in, you know, decades. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that, sure, we now have effective birth control methods, and people use condoms as a way of preventing pregnancy. But it turns out they also reduce the rates of STIs. As we move to hormonal contraception, unless there's a discussion around screening for STIs or using barrier methods like condoms, we've wound up shifting the focus around pregnancy prevention rather than prevention of sexually transmitted infections. That's why you have to think about both. Now, that burden shouldn't just go on women. The rates that we've seen have increased for men as well. So this is not something that's just about women's behavior or women's sexual health. On top of all that, if you compare the U.S. to every single Western country, we have the highest rates of sexually transmitted infection. I don't think it's because Americans are more sexually active or promiscuous. I think it has to do, again, with access to care and sort of routinizing around the issues of sexual health. So we've seen these increases. Part of that, I think, has been that our healthcare system is not available for everyone. And if you live in more rural areas or in the deep South, you may not have access to care like you might in more urban areas, such as up and down the East Coast or out on the West Coast. All of those, I think, have contributed to the higher rates. So discussions now have to shift from beyond just pregnancy prevention to sexually transmitted infection prevention as well. And again, the framework, I think, for that has to be talking about sexual health so that people can make informed and healthy decisions for themselves in order to have good sex, in order to not have diseases.
If we're seeing these headlines, though, and these numbers that pregnancies are at a historic low, that people are putting off sex, then why is there this disconnect?
Because if you're sexually active, you're going to be at risk. So although we're seeing, and I think it's a good thing, a delay in sexual debut in adolescence. We're seeing lower pregnancy rates. That whole discussion has to be around just not women and women's access to care. Remember, women get sexually transmitted infections almost exclusively from men, and yet our screening activities are around screening women. Women go in routinely for annual Pap tests, or if they're not, if they don't have HPV, they may be able to go every 3 years. There is really not much in place for young men to be screened. That's true for heterosexual, bisexual, or gay men. So we're only dealing with half of the equation. What we wind up seeing are numbers like this, in which the only population that's being routinely screened are women who access care around pregnancy prevention. That's a problem that's going to have to be addressed.
And you brought up HPV, human papilloma virus. Is this the most common sexually transmitted disease?
It is. So if we look at the course of a lifetime, basically about 70% of adults will have had a human papilloma infection somewhere in their genital tract. So I view it as sort of a marker of sexual activity. And yet we have a vaccine that is highly effective in preventing HPV infection from developing into diseases. And we have some of the lowest rates of uptake of vaccination in our young adults.
David, I want to follow up with you here. You were quoted in a CNN article mentioning that the rise of dating apps are also a contributing factor.
Well, I think that's one factor among many, but I do just want to pick up on a point that Dr. Leone made, which is that young women accessing reproductive health services, contraceptives, IUDs, we have unintentionally got in a situation where we're having success at reducing unplanned pregnancies, but what's not happening is screening and testing for STDs. So although it sounds counterintuitive, I think for the average person, it really speaks to kind of a fundamental problem we have within the healthcare system, where providers and patients need to be talking much more openly and having STD screening. The CDC, and Dr. Lone can speak to this, has very good standards of care that are out there. And for most people should be screened, young people particularly, on a yearly basis for STDs. And some who are at higher risk should be tested even more often, including gay men who are on PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, to prevent HIV infection. So these are all opportunities to intervene in STD rates if we can move the healthcare system to be doing more around sexual health and STD screening.
And here we are in Wisconsin. We would like to know, how is Wisconsin impacted by STD infections?
Well, I can generally tell you kind of the national trends, but in Wisconsin, over the last 5 years, for example, we've seen a 44% increase in syphilis, a 37% increase in gonorrhea, and a 12% increase in chlamydia. So Wisconsin is right up there with every other state in terms of having seen dramatic increases. Those are, by the way, those are the three federally reportable STDs, in addition to HIV, which is also reported through a separate system federally. But those are the three STDs we monitor. There are other STDs as well. And one of the things I want to make sure that your listeners hear a little bit more about is the serious health consequences of undiagnosed and untreated STDs, some of which have lifelong implications for some people, particularly women. And then I think another very important point to be drawing out is a point that Dr. Leone already made, which is the clinical intersection between having an STD and getting HIV. That's often not understood by people as well. There's a huge relationship and risk for getting HIV infection if you also have another STD.
Dr. Leone, David set you up with a number of questions there. What happens first, question one, if an STD goes undiagnosed?
Well, I think David points up some really excellent points. And so because many STIs, majority of the infections, are asymptomatic when a person first gets them, there's an opportunity to screen and treat before they develop disease. Now, what we're concerned about are several things. So obviously for women, there's big concerns around reproductive health. Gonorrhea and chlamydia in particular are associated with infertility if a woman is not treated early. So we're trying to make sure women are screened in order to be able to make sure they don't develop pelvic inflammatory disease, fallopian tube scarring that can lead to infertility. In fact, chlamydia is the number one preventable cause of tubal infertility in women. In the case of all of those STIs, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis, we see an increased risk of HIV acquisition. That increase has to do with the inflammation that occurs in the genital tract that allows HIV to infect more easily by breaching the barrier of the skin of the genital tract or the mucosal surface. In the case of syphilis, there's an ulcer that can appear early on that allows cells, inflammatory cells, to come into the genital tract that are targets for HIV acquisition. And if a person has HIV and they get a sexually transmitted infection, all three of those increase the shedding of HIV, which can lead to transmission. So we view these things as, again, prevention. And prevention has to start with changing behavior, obviously. But I view sex as sort of inevitable for adults. So the idea that we tell all adults that they shouldn't have sex is sort of missing the point that sexual activity is going to happen. We should empower people to be able to make safe choices, and that means being screened.
Talking right now with Dr. Peter Leone. He's a professor of medicine and adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina, an expert on sexually transmitted diseases. Also with us is David Harvey. He's the head of a national public health organization, the National Coalition of STD Directors. We're breaking down a new CDC report showing STDs at an all-time high. You can join this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think there is a stigma that's cast around STDs? Are you concerned about a son or a daughter getting an STD? Join in, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Leone, you did say sometimes that you don't detect symptoms, but could you break down for us symptoms that might be readily available to a person that they could detect if they would say, first of all, have chlamydia, for example?
Well, first I'd like to say that the majority of chlamydia infections in particular are asymptomatic. So 85% of the infections would be missed if you didn't get screened. So the absence of symptoms doesn't mean the absence of a sexually transmitted infection. So that's the reason why David had mentioned about routine screening on an annual basis for most groups and more frequently for higher-risk individuals. In the case of chlamydia, for men, if they have symptoms, they can have burning on urination or penile discharge, so either pus or yellowish fluid that comes out of their penis can be a sign of either chlamydia or gonorrhea. For women, they may not have any symptoms until they develop pelvic inflammatory disease, which can present as abdominal pain, lower abdominal pain, and fever. So we can miss those things. And in men who have sex with men or women who engage in anal intercourse, we can see anal infections with chlamydia, which can cause a rectal discharge or pain. But again, frequently, no symptoms.
How about gonorrhea?
Gonorrhea in men does usually cause symptoms if they're infected in their urethra. So for men, we would see burning on urination or penile discharge. However, most rectal infections and throat infections, both in men and women, cause no symptoms. And we're finding much higher rates of carriage in the throat and in the rectum in men and women who engage in a receptive anal intercourse. In those cases, if they have symptoms, there's virtually none in the throat. In the rectal area, they may have pain with defecation or rectal discharge. Those can be signs or symptoms of other things as well, but may represent having a sexually transmitted infection.
And finally, what about syphilis? Any symptoms?
Well, syphilis is the great masquerader. It can look like a lot of other conditions, and syphilis has multiple stages of infection. So when a person first gets syphilis, virtually everybody develops what we call a chancre. It's an ulcer or a sore or lesion that actually doesn't hurt. It occurs at the point of inoculation. Unlike gonorrhea and chlamydia that are transmitted through sexual fluids, syphilis is transmitted through skin-to-skin contact. However, if a person's not treated, that lesion will go away. Now, if those lesions occur in the vagina or in the rectum or in the throat, they may be entirely missed. Or if a person goes in to be seen, unless a clinician is thinking about it, that diagnosis might be missed. The lesion goes away, and then a person go on into what we call a secondary stage of syphilis, in which case they can develop a rash, low-grade fever, swollen lymph nodes. It can look like a viral infection. And that, too, will go away unless a person is treated. Then they go into what we call latent syphilis, which can persist in the body for many, many years. In the case of women, the concern is if they're of reproductive age and they get pregnant, unless they're screened and treated during pregnancy, they can transmit that infection to a newborn infant. And as a result, we've seen a dramatic increase in congenital syphilis over the last 3 years. In fact, last year we had over 600 cases, or 2016, over 600 cases of congenital syphilis, an entirely preventable outcome, should not happen and represents a failure in our healthcare delivery system, period.
Let's take a call now. Louise is joining us in Neenah. Go ahead, Louise.
I'm just wondering how many of these are not preventable, but curable at all? I mean, do some of these things ever go away, like HPV and herpes? And I'm asking because I think there are a lot of people who are, you know, older like me and might want to get back into the dating scene. I don't even want to step out there. You know, is it ever going to be safe?
Well, there is no such thing as safe sex. So the idea is to make it safer. Most of the STIs that we're talking about, you can treat and cure. So gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis are all curable. So if you get treated, that's the end of the story, unless you've got a disease complication. In the case of HPV, 95%, 96% of HPV infections result in nothing. If a person does go on to develop disease, the two things we worry about are warts, genital warts, and cancer. For women, it's cervical cancer. For men, in particular, HIV-infected men, we worry about anal cancer. And now we know that human papillomavirus is responsible for about a third of head and neck cancers. This is entirely preventable by being vaccinated. For those of us that are older, and I include myself in that group, it's probably too late to have any benefit from the HPV vaccine. But that means just going in and getting screened. In the case of women, getting an annual pap smear, or if they're HPV negative, getting screened less frequently, once every 2 to 3 years. In the case of herpes, unfortunately, once infected, always infected. And although we have effective therapies, they really haven't had a dramatic increase in terms of reducing transmission. So there are multiple steps that need to be done. And again, I think this all comes back down to you need to know your status, because not knowing it doesn't mean that you won't develop disease complications or transmit it to other people.
Well, Louise, thank you so much for calling in. What does an exam look like, or, you know, this preventative care look like? What can people expect to go in and to be tested?
Well, I can address sort of the medical aspects. I'll let David talk about what that might look like in terms of a person going into a clinic, an STI clinic, STD clinic, or the services that providers might be able to provide. We have tests now that allow people to pee into a cup, and that's true for both men and women, collective vaginal swab.
And I'm going to have to stop you right there. We're going to come back to that.
Okay.
We have a news break coming up. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network, 800-642-1234. Health officials are telling us STDs, sexually transmitted diseases, are on the rise. We're learning more about the latest numbers on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently revealed a nationwide analysis detailing that over 2 million people in the U.S. were infected with instances of sexually transmitted disease such as chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis in 2016 alone. Two guests with us, David Harvey, Executive Director of a National Public Health Organization, National Coalition of STD Directors, and Dr. Peter Leone, who's an Adjunct Professor of Epidemiology at the University of North Carolina. Taking your questions as well on STDs, 800-642-1234. Are public service campaigns enough to stop the rise of STDs? What else can we do to educate people? 800-642-1234. You can post your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Getting back to testing, and we had a Facebook post here from Sally, and Sally was interested in the basically what was happening with her daughter, who was getting tested and receiving an insurance bill and of $227 for STD testing, saying this is not affordable for many people. Can we address the testing?
Yeah, I'll let David weigh in on that.
Yeah, I'm happy to start a conversation about that. But I think, boy, is that an excellent question. And this is one of the barriers that we have. How to finance testing. And as your caller or the person who posted on Facebook just indicated, it is a barrier for some people to pay for testing because insurance either does or does not completely cover the costs of screening, which speaks to the enormous need we have for standalone STD clinics in the United States. Unfortunately, we've had a cutback in funding for these programs, but the advantage of STD clinics is that most often the services are free. You get testing and screening for free, and it is confidential. I appreciate your caller, Louise, who also called in, because one of the major problems we have is shame and stigma. You know, having programs like this on the radio where we're talking openly and honestly about people's needs and their questions that they have about STDs is an incredibly important thing for us to be doing. Talking openly and honestly is going to be the way that we start to curb STDs in America. But back to STD clinics, I want to make sure that your callers in Wisconsin, you know, have some immediate local resources that they can rely on. And so fortunately in Wisconsin, there are programs, there are STD clinics that are standalone programs through the public health department. And one that I would just recommend for your callers is in Milwaukee. If you're in another part of the state, you can certainly call them and ask about how to best access services. But the Kenan Health Center at 3200 North 36th Street in Milwaukee is one excellent resource. They provide confidential, free or low-cost services, and their phone number is 414-286-8840.
And I want to jump in here for a moment with, we were looking at public service campaigns yesterday, and this one in particular from Planned Parenthood. I just want to hear a clip of that.
Half of all people will get an STD and most don't know it.
Young people account for the largest percentage of new HIV infections in the U.S. each year.
Almost all STDs, including HIV, are treatable and many are curable.
STD tests are quick, easy, and painless.
A lot of the time, all you have to do is pee in a cup.
I got tested.
I got tested.
I got tested.
I got tested. Did you?
So they're a public service campaign on STDs. Do youth under 18 need their parent or guardian's permission for testing and treatment of STDs?
Another excellent question. Peter, do you want to start out with that one?
It depends on the state. Most states do allow for youth to go in and be screened and for that not to be disclosed. In particular, as David talked about, with STI programs that are run by counties or by state health departments, in those cases, it is protected and confidential. Where there have been problems have been around insured individuals, and that's something I know David has been addressing through the National Coalition of STD Directors, in which insurance is viewed as a commodity, and the customer is the parent frequently, not the kid. And we've been really pushing to ensure that STI screening remains confidential for youth instead of getting a line item listing of everything that's being done. David, maybe you can weigh in a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, you spoke very well to that issue, but again, this is a set of issues and barriers to testing and screening, and we need to make sure that we do everything we can to increase access for young people as well as older people to confidential free testing. I will tell you as well that I just want to point to an additional two things. One is there is a growing trend in the United States to be looking at a new model, which is called express clinics, where people come into a program, they are using an iPad to register, they're self-collecting swabs to hand over to a provider for testing, and then they get a text or a message to come in within a very short amount of time if, in fact, they're positive for an STD to get treatment. And that's having some very positive impacts, particularly with young people. But these are not services that are available throughout the country, and I think they work with some groups and not well for others. But express STD clinics is something that we need to be looking at nationwide. The second thing I wanted to point out as well, and Dr. Leone mentioned this, but something that we call extragenital testing, three-site testing, is something that's very important for people to understand and for providers to understand. Because one way to ensure that we don't miss someone who has an STD is to ensure that we're doing comprehensive testing. So it's not just blood and urine, but it's also taking swabs from the rectum and the mouth. And that's important for people to know. And if people want more information on that, my organization, together with the National Alliance of State AIDS Directors, just released a document yesterday via our website that talks all about extragenital testing, and you can get a copy of that at ncsddc.org, in addition to accessing all kinds of other information about STDs.
We have several questions here. Let's go to Kyle first in Muskego. Go ahead, Kyle.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, you're on.
Hey, good morning.
I don't want to pull away from the need for testing because I think that that's really important. But I just wanted to bring up that if the goal is to curb the ratios of sexually transmitted diseases and try and get those down, the biggest correlation that I've seen in any study that I've read with STDs also goes along with teen pregnancy. Anywhere where there's high teen pregnancy, there's high STD spread. And I don't think teen pregnancy is the cause of STD spread. I think that the cause for both of those is to do with poorly educated children or children just not understanding the risks and dangers of leading sexually active lives. And as far as like being aware of STDs, just from a personal note from friends that I have that lead pretty irresponsible lives, whenever they have a pregnancy scare and the pregnancy scare comes back negative, instead of, oh, I got to make smarter choices with my life, the reaction is usually, oh, I can go back to being irresponsible.
Dr. Leone.
Yeah, I, you know, you won't get any pushback from me that we should be talking about delaying sexual debut, and for young adults, abstinence can and should be included in a much broader discussion around sexual health. But I do view sex as sort of like eating, and that it's inevitable and it's required for us to continue to exist as a species. So good sexual behavior is important. It's a little bit hard to know what that risk is, though, when you start looking at the rates. So for some individuals, the lifetime risk can be quite high with what we consider to be pretty normative behavior, low-risk behavior. So we'll just use HIV as an example. For young black MSM, the estimated lifetime risk of HIV acquisition now is 50% over the course of a lifetime, 50%. If you look at diseases like herpes, the median number for prevalence for herpes in the U.S. for African-American women to get to somewhere around 20-25% prevalence for herpes is about two to four lifetime partners, numbers which are not high by anybody's standard. So although I do agree we should be telling kids, look, wait, make sure you're making informed decisions, and you're absolutely right, pregnancy and being negative on a pregnancy test doesn't sort of absolve you for responsibility. We do need to make screening much more accessible. And for women in particular, their risk is not necessarily associated with them. It's associated with their male partners. So I've seen plenty of women with STIs in which they've had one lifetime partner, and yet they come in with herpes or chlamydia or gonorrhea, and it turns out that their male partners had multiple partners. So risk assessment tends to break down, unfortunately, for women. And women in particular have some of the highest consequences in terms of reproductive issues around sexually transmitted infections.
Kyle, thanks for the call. Quickly, let's go to Mary in Pewaukee, who's been waiting. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning, Kate and your guests. And I just wanted to say that, and you touched base on it after I made the phone call to you that, Planned Parenthood, whom I have supported, does have preventive measures. So the education and to support Planned Parenthood, especially in our rural areas, is extremely important so that people will have another option because there are so few clinics. And I certainly would support that new, what they were talking about, the STD. What is it called?
David.
Express clinics, but caller, I think the point that you make is so important. We need family planning and Planned Parenthood to be providers that continue in this country to have support, to have state and federal financing in order to provide STD screening services for women and for some men. It's an essential federal program.
Well, Mary.
Oh. I was going to just add that Planned Parenthood really has been under attack. We need to support them, in particular around STI screening, and they do screen men. It's an important access to care point.
And we're going to have to leave it there with this discussion. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Peter Leone and David Harvey. That was Dr. Peter Leone. He is a professor of medicine and an adjunct professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina, an expert on sexually transmitted diseases. David Harvey, also with us, executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors. This hour of the morning show was produced by Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer and provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and it's conversations like this you can find on the Ideas Network.